One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
All right, Majority Report listeners, we have a final deal. As you know, Credo is sponsoring the show for the rest of 2013, just a couple more days. We have a final deal that ends on New Year's Eve. You will be able to get, with Credo Mobile, a free Google Nexus 5 and an up to $350 buyout credit. That means they'll give you a credit on your Credo bill for up to $350 to get you out of your own old contract, plus a free Google Nexus 5. You know all about Credo Action. They fight for progressive values. Credo Mobile gives 1% of its revenue to fund progressive nonprofits. Check it out. Go to credomobile.com/Sam for your deal. This is only good until the end of the year, and then it all goes away. credomobile.com/Sam. We've got links on the front page of majority.fm. Check it out now.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get a feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, December 31st, 2013. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Best of 2013 continues, ladies and gentlemen. And what a show we have for you today on New Year's Eve. What better way than to prepare your body for the incredible punishment you will provide for it tonight? Or if you're like me, the evening at home watching maybe a TV show or something like that, and you'll be in bed by 10:30 if it's a late night, after you put the kids to bed, after they have screamed, even when they're 9 months old, that they want to see the ball drop and blah, 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 and then they fall asleep because they can't stay up that late anyways. Mila, please, just go to bed. It's not that big of a deal. Blah, blah, blah. Anyways, for you today, we have three interviews from 2013. This is a big one, folks. Three interviews. One from Sarah Slaman. She is the young adult who was shut down by the Texas State Legislature when she wanted to testify as to what the Texas legislature was doing in regards to women's rights to have sovereignty over their own body. We also hear from Sandra Steingraber. She's an environmentalist, and we spoke to her shortly after she got out of prison. And she speaks as to why she felt it was necessary for her to go to prison, even with young children at home. And a guy named John Mullins, who spoke up at a at basically a town hall his congressman was having about the impact of the sequester. And all of these interviews are very inspirational. We thought it might be nice to recall those moments of 2013 where people stood up and stopped waiting for politicians and fought back. And so listen to those interviews, enjoy them. I hope you find them as inspirational as we do here. And for members, speaking of inspiration, an interview from the deep archives that Janine did with the late, great Howard Zinn back from March of 2006. So enjoy all of these interviews, folks. I wish you a happy new year. Again, I want to thank you for everything, for all of your support for this program in 2013. We hope you will continue that support in 2014 because, frankly, we can't do it without you. So I hope you've enjoyed everything we were able to bring for you in 2013. Enjoy these interviews. We will have one more best of this week, and then we will be back live on Friday with Cliff Schechter. All right, so let's first hear from Sarah Slayman. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. We played the 3 minutes of her testimony yesterday on this program.
Sarah Slayman. Thank you, Chair and Committee. My name is Sarah Slayman. I'm constituent of Senator Whitmire. I'm here to testify against SB1 because I'm tired of Republican primary politics, misogyny, and greed dominating the state I was born, raised, and schooled in. And, you know, I had some really eloquent remarks written out, but you guys have just worn me down all day with all this terrible science and glad-handing. And to be frank, I get to move to New York next month, so I don't have to live in fear of you Texas legislators anymore and what you're going to do to my education system or my health care system, because I'm going to a state that doesn't kill its own inmates. That's how pro-life it is up there. I will thank you, though, first. It was destiny that you would discriminate against us and try to force your way inside the bodies of Texas women. Thank you for finally working against us women so publicly and not in the shadows like you're used to. Thank you for every single bad press conference with your bad information. Thank you for every hateful statement degrading women and girls to sex objects and broodmares and bald eagles and leather wallets like your eloquent pro-life supporters have done today. Thank you for being you, Texas legislature. You have radicalized hundreds of thousands of us. And no matter what you do for the next 22 days, women and their allies are coming for you. Let's start down the line. Senator Campbell, you're an ophthalmologist, so I won't be making you the expert on reproductive health. We can give you all the children with chlamydia and herpes in their eyes since we don't have sex ed in this state. And Senator Hagar, you're about as helpful. You are about as... Excuse me. This is my government, ma'am. I will judge you. I will judge you, ma'am. Is this counting against my time?
Yes, it is.
The senator talking against me?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, I will just go ahead and talk over her. And this is how big of a fraud I knew you were for being so proud of these proceedings all night. It's a low bar that you hold yourself to that you simply allowed us to speak. And I will speak against an ophthalmologist who says, everyone on the internet can see what you're doing right now. This is a farce. The Texas legislator is a bunch of liars who hate women.
Our next witness is Gary Oldham. Is Gary Oldham here?
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Mr. Oldham.
Thank you. My name is Gary Oldham. I live in...
And it is a pleasure to be speaking to her in person. Sarah Slayman, welcome to the program.
Hi, Sam. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Sarah, this your testimony the other day in front of the... and I'm not sure exactly what the specific committee was. You'll tell us.
The Health and Human Services Committee.
Health and Human Services Committee in the Texas Senate. Was really impressive. And I want to talk about first what you got up to the mic. You said I had a prepared statement, but I've been here all day, and you seemed quite. You basically seem just fed up with what you heard. Just tell us what your day was like. What did you hear? What time did you get to the Senate?
I left a relative's house about 90 miles outside of Austin at 5:30 a.m. so I could get to the Capitol a little before 7 to help narrow Texas out with some volunteer check-in stuff. I got in line to register for oral testimony around 9 a.m. I got out of that line at 10:30 a.m. and then waited in an auditorium watching testimony throughout the day until I was eventually called into a room to testify at 11:15 p.m. So it was a very long day.
And what did you hear over the course of that nearly 12 hours?
I heard a lot of what I'd been hearing since I originally went to testify on June 20th. You know, it doesn't matter how much expert medical testimony we bring. It doesn't matter how many State Department officials who have the real facts about abortion in Texas came forward. The other side just got to constantly barrage us with pseudoscience and a lot of misogynistic insults, just person after person going up referencing murder, killing, promiscuity, being selfish. You know, all that talk about babies as punishment for bad girls, for fallen women. And when they got to a testimony of a woman who had to talk about her medically necessary abortion of a child who would be born with spina bifida, I was really moved because this woman and her husband had spent a lot of their savings on in vitro to get pregnant with that child in the first place. It was devastating. And the anti-choicer who testified after was sitting right next to her and took an opportunity to say, I know two people who have adopted children with spina bifida. And not a word. It was so pointed, and everyone reacted in person and on social media with, did she just really say that? That was awful. How horrendous. But not a word from a person on the committee, and certainly not from committee chairwoman Senator Jay Nelson. And that woman who had had the abortion had testified through furious, painful tears, and she remained silent and didn't, you know, strike out. I don't know what I would have done. So at that point, I scrapped my speech and just began to research every Republican on the committee.
And so what were you sitting there on? Did you have your computer with you? Is that it? I mean,
I had my iPhone. I did that from a smartphone. You got a smartphone, you can get them.
And so now your testimony was not complete. at one point, there was, as far as I could count, at least two or maybe three state troopers, I guess, who basically picked you up and pulled you out of there.
Yeah, it ended up being five eventually, but two pulled me out with a third coming behind them. Yeah.
And where did they did they just escort you out of the building? What happened?
They took me out, and they were kind of like leading me down this kind of dead-end hallway, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to get charged with something now. And their sergeant was coming. So I think they were getting ready to, like, officially, you know, do something with me. But thankfully, due to the wonder of, you know, all the proceedings being shown on the rooms in the Capitol and social media, a bunch of people rushed upstairs and just, like, refused to isolate me with the police and stayed until I made it clear that you're going to go get my bag out of that room and I'm going to drive out of this Capitol a free person because I haven't broken the law.
And I want to get to what your testimony would have been. We're going to give you the full time to say it. But are you going to are you planning to take any action? I mean, is there any legal recourse for your being shut down ostensibly because you were criticizing the legitimacy of an optometrist basically functioning in her words as some type of expert on reproductive care?
Yeah, we looked into the House and Senate chamber rules. I did not break any rule there. People all throughout the day had spoken in the tone I had spoken, just on the other side, and had been, you know, unfactual and committed, like, you know, character defamation. I literally just pointed out that Donna Campbell is a practicing ophthalmologist and hasn't used her emergency licensing in a long time. That's all I pointed out. So a lot of people have been talking about First Amendment rights violations, but in my opinion, I mean, I don't know these days, you know, in a post 9/11 America, I don't know how good of a chance I would have with a case like that. If anyone thinks I'm wrong about that, feel free to reach out to me at Victoria and Prude on Twitter and I'll listen, but I actually don't have a lot of hope in a First Amendment case on that.
Right. All right. So what, so tell us, what did you originally plan to say?
Well, remember that I only had 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. So I had compiled basic facts about each member of the committee that was there and the author of the bill, Glenn Hagar. And I was going to say, like, spit out a fact and then, like, give, you know, like, a judgment of it. So, like, in Glenn Hagar's defense, it was going to be that, like, 80% of children in one of his district schools depend on the free lunch program. He doesn't have time to make sure and find out why these children have to live in poverty, but he does have time to regulate, you know, women's bodies and talk about the unborn and stuff like that. That was an example of how I was going to go down the line towards Senator Taylor, to Senator Schwertner and to Senator Nelson herself.
And just give us a just for those people who and when we've certainly talked about the legislation, but talk to us about the legislation that, I mean, you know, by all accounts at this point, it looks like it's going to end up passing. But who knows? But what is it that they're trying to push down there?
So what they're trying to do is bring up an unconstitutional challenge about viability. The Supreme Court has ruled that viability is at 24 weeks. They're trying to enforce this bad standard, this non-substantiated idea of fetal pain before 20 weeks as a reason to do that. They can't come up with a study in any medical journal that's peer-reviewed. They can come up with plenty of community-reviewed for laymen out there. Community-reviewed means your friends can write the paper. It's not peer-reviewed. And they're trying to use that to challenge at, you know, the Supreme Court level, which is a complete waste of Texas money and time. That will fail the court level like everyone else's challenge does. This is also a drive to enrich the Perry family. Mila Perry Jones, older sister of Governor Perry, is the head lobbyist for Ambulatory Surgical Alliance and doctor-owned hospitals in Texas. All hospitals that didn't already meet the standards would be required to upgrade to ambulatory surgical standards, which are actually less regulated than the already current abortion providers. So,
all right, now, and I want to make something. I want to just explain what this these standards are. Is basically, it's just saying that they need to have the functions essentially of emergency care, I guess, right? I mean, is that
absolutely, yeah. Most abortions don't require surgical intervention, so it's arduous that way. Why do you need a surgical center to provide the RU486 pill? You don't. And then second of all, there's all kinds of just sweet spots in there for the hospital construction industry. You need extra janitor's closets. You need a men's locker room. Sam, how many abortion clinics do you think need more men's locker room in Texas?
Right.
So it's a lot of giveaways. It's a lot, and most surprisingly, in a political sense, this shows how brazen they are. This is huge government intervention. This is huge mandates, and of upgrades for private businesses with no appropriation of funds. It's just backwards, pretty much in every instance you can think.
And there's a whole raft of surgical procedures that are performed in doctor's offices, essentially, that don't require.
Yeah, like vasectomies. Vasectomies, right?
Yeah.
There's no regulations for vasectomies like that, or like really any other procedure like that in the state of Texas. It all comes back to women's reproductive choice.
And, you know, you also, during the course of the testimony, spoke about essentially the other things that you felt that the Texas state legislature was dropping the ball on. Give me a sense of what your background has been. I mean, I know you're obviously very politically active, but just give us a sense of what you've been up to. And also just give us a sense of your background.
Well, I graduated from the University of Houston in 2008 with a degree in political science. But I feel like I need to make this point really clear. You get Sarah Slamans by making sure your daughters have access to speech and debate programs. You get Sarah Slamans by making sure that your public school districts have to maintain their constitutional law programs. I had access to incredible programs in Texas public school that there's just no longer any funding for. And if we don't teach our young people to be civic and how to make their points clear, they'll resort to guns or they'll resort to apathy, okay? So that was a huge part of my development as a person who could, you know, be politicized and politicize others. Like many people in my generation, you know, I'm 28 years old, the Iraq War seriously radicalized me. When I was 17 years old, I got a very fresh idea of just how deceptive and forceful a government could be when the entire world was against it. So for the past 10 or 11 years, I've been involved, you know, in anything from wage theft, feminist issues, trying as hard as I can to resuscitate the Democratic Party in Texas before I even gave up on that. I mean, it's been across the board wherever I thought I could help in Texas at a grassroots level.
And you also, during your testimony, you thanked the Texas state legislature for being so out front with what you perceived their agenda has been all along. Just to talk about that a little bit and what you think the impact that has had on people who are not as politically engaged as you obviously have been.
Well, a big big punch to the gut happened in 2011. And that's when Senator Dan Patrick from Houston passed this mandatory transvaginal ultrasound bill. Now, it wasn't just devastating effects for Texas. After we passed that law, seven other states have had it. Most recently, the governor of Wisconsin signed it in. Thankfully, they have a federal injunction.
Right.
But the mandatory transvaginal ultrasound was a clear, kind of a shining moment on their new pivot. So remember in the 90s, it was just nonstop talk about the unborn. But at a constitutional level, they just kept getting smacked down. Now that they've switched to the women's health and the women's right to know, they can disguise it all as all this health care legislation. So when I said, you know, thanks for being willing to do it in the open, that's because after 2011 and we women realized how, you know, how this had just come out of nowhere and happened so fast while we were disorganized, we vowed that we had to work. And since 2011, there have been numerous grassroots activists and women's health organizations like NARO, Planned Parenthood, who have been working very diligently to bring attention to the harm that this legislation could do, not only in Texas, but how it spreads. Like, it's, you know, it's not a coincidence that this is all happening everywhere at the same time.
And I mean, give me a sense of, you know, it's interesting because, you know, when we called you for the show, you had you indicated to my producer, Michael, that you had heard us on Air America back in the day. And, you mm-hmm. know, my sense has always been that those progressive folks who are living in a red state have a are in many ways so much more activated because they are living with the implications.
We live it.
Yes, I mean, it's not a potential. You're going through it every day. Do you get the sense that in Texas, though? I mean, have you seen a level of awareness changing? I mean, obviously, Texas is one of those states because of demographics is considered to be turning sort of more purple
The cities are blue for all intents and purposes. You know, Dallas, Austin, and Houston for the past four cycles have occasionally or consistently gone blue. You know, Travis County's always been this blue dot in the sea of red. But, yes, you know, the Texas legislature, this is historic. They have never experienced a session like this or a second special session. They have never seen this level of participation in just common committee hearings. They've never, ever had a citizen's filibuster kill a bill the way we did on June 25th when, you know, there was 20 minutes left to go and the Democrats couldn't get out of the Senate, you know, with our skins intact. They've never experienced that. So while I don't know how much momentum it will take and how long it will take to really attack the structural problems for the minority party in Texas, I know for sure that participation has ramped up in a huge way.
Do you get the sense that that people who, participation is ramped up? I mean, do you get the sense that this is sort of spreading to people who has it changed people's perspective? I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, how much of what is happening in Texas is a function of demographics and how much of it is a function of people finally engaging, people who may have casually just voted or self-identified as conservative or Republican, and now they're just being repulsed at what's happening in terms of their rights?
A lot of what's happening is a breaking point for women. You know, we have a lot of great allies, but this has undeniably been driven by a lot of younger women and some older women in Texas. So, on one hand, you're right, it's demographics. It's young women who live in Austin, have the ability to get there, and, they're young. They depend on these clinics for low-cost care for a variety of things, not just abortion access. So, on one hand, it's that. As far as participation, that's where it's a long game. That's where, you know, to be completely honest, the Texas Democratic Party is crippled. It's anemic. And they have to, in my sense, move out of Austin. They have to get deeper into Harris County. They have to get deeper into Tarrant County. They have to get deeper into West Texas. There are younger people there, and there are demographics changing there, and they need to be reached out to and recognized. You can't do everything from Austin. Only 1 million people there. You know, Texas is more diverse than Austin. So that's the long game, but I think that you know, people seeing, wow, those Democrats aren't just going to shut up and take it there. That's going to help that long game.
And one of the things you mentioned in your testimony, too, was that you were leaving Texas. I want to ask you about, well, I mean, tell us why. You know, and particularly, you know, in light of, you know, you're articulating sort of a political savvy about Texas that I would imagine is maybe not is pretty close to just about every anybody who's sort of professionally involved in politics in Texas. Why not stay there? Why move?
Well, the clearest point that I should make is, you know, that I didn't have the context to discuss in the hearing was the man I love that I've been with for the past 3 years was born and raised in New York. We're going back to his home, you know. We cannot afford to get pregnant in this state. The idea of, you know, no matter how hard we try, me getting pregnant here and then me having to go into a clinic and them getting to rape me, getting to shove a probe into me because it's mandated by Texas law is unbearable for us. It's unbearable. I also need health care. I haven't had health care for 5 years. Organizing gigs, grassroots politics, that doesn't pay well. You don't get benefits
right.
with that. I desperately need health care. I need regular checkups. And New York has accepted federal expansion of Medicaid. New York protects women's right to choose. I can relax on those issues in New York. I'm not going to lie and say that my partner and I haven't discussed that maybe plans might have to change, that if I get a convincing enough argument that I can finally get a place at the table to affect how we organize in Texas, that I wouldn't consider staying here. But that opportunity would have to present itself. I can't fall behind a party structure that's been failing for 30 years here, you know. They've excluded me. And now that I've shown them that they are, that people are looking for pushback, they are looking for anger, they don't want to play the decorum game, they're a little bit more open. So we'll see what happens. But I also have some very best friends in New York, and it's an amazing city. And while I'm still young and don't have kids, I'd kind of like the experience to live there.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you do end up making it to New York, we've got to have you in. We rarely have people in studio, mostly as a function of our studio not being terribly fancy. But we'd love to have you in when you hit New York. Let me, and I assume you're going to continue being politically active in this state. There's a lot of we don't have the necessarily the same issue set, but there's a lot to be done here.
Oh, yeah. New York's got plenty of problems. I mean, don't get me wrong. New York is the model for the serious income inequality that defines this country at the moment. You know, there's all kinds of issues. The police state in New York, you know, the fact that you guys have such large, broad, expansive surveillance. If I was in New York, I'd really want to look at, you know, helping low-income communities. Women's prison reform and working, you know, to understand why we need as many police as we do in New York City. So instead of Rick Perry, I think I'd be looking more towards people like Ray Kelly to critique once I got to New York.
And just give me a sense, are your parents politically active? I mean, I have an 8-year-old daughter.
You want to know how someone like me came out of Texas?
Well, I know. I just want to know how someone like you came out of anywhere, frankly. But I got an 8-year-old daughter, and I would be terribly excited if she was as well-spoken and as well-informed in politics as you are at age 28.
Well, when I was 3 years old, my mom would set me in front of C-SPAN, and I would sit there and point at the TV and shake my fingers at it. And she, I don't know what she thought I was doing, but apparently I was actually engaging in policy debates at that young of an age with the Reagan Congresses. And then my parents were actually opposites. My dad, I think, if you could even describe him, tomorrow will be 12 days that he's passed. He's no longer with us.
I'm sorry to hear
12
that.
Years that he's passed. I'm sorry. He was kind of a conservative libertarian almost. He was very much a Texan before you could describe him in any other way, as like a middle-aged man or an Arab American. Like, he was very much a conservative libertarian. My mom, on the other hand, is very much what you describe as a progressive, a liberal. And as I was growing up, Sunday mornings were about watching my parents basically have a cool, like, playful, sometimes not so playful, fight about Meet the Press. They would watch Meet the Press in front of us, tussle over every issue of Bill Clinton, and we would get to watch, you know, political discourse. and disagreement was okay in our house. And that was a huge part of how my brother and I got to be the way we are.
And give me a sense. I also wanted to, you know, one thing that strikes me, yesterday we played your testimony, and then we followed it up, something that was unrelated. A journalist, an independent journalist, confronting some NSA recruiters at a language program that she was attending. And
I referenced that in an article with the Daily Dot, actually. It's a huge deal, and it's one of the only ways, it's one of the best ways that social media is kind of prevailing over mainstream news, and independent journalism is prevailing. And it's a great idea of people with access and privilege turning it on its head. You know, it's easy to just accept the NSA gig, you know, accept the intelligence gig, but to go in there and try and find out what's happening is a really brave sacrifice of privilege, and it's what's necessary at this time. People working 2 and 3 jobs and being afraid to become one of, you know, the 18 million unemployed people in this country, they can't go to state hearings. They can't infiltrate meetings. So we need more of that.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that we're seeing more of it. I mean, you know, and I think about what's happening in North Carolina right now, where each week we have tens, if not hundreds sometimes, people getting arrested, fighting back about what's happening in North Carolina. There just seems to be, and perhaps maybe some of this is coming out of the wake of Occupy in some respects, as people get training and move into other areas or are simply inspired by it. But it seems to me that there's just a heightened level of direct activism we're seeing in this country.
I definitely agree that people have begun to realize that I have the power. I can be a witness. I don't have to wait for a party to lead me somewhere. And you're right. You know, I was a part of Occupy Houston. I was in a part of a network with a lot of Occupy activists. And, you know, Occupy fizzled when it fizzled. But you're absolutely correct. People linked up. People got training. People got skills. And people got roughed up by the intelligence, you know, establishment. And people got roughed up by the police. And it does kind of bring back to mind, like, we might be actually nearing towards that civil era type moment. You know, it took white kids going down south getting their heads busted on TV for people to say, wow, I've got to get in there and actually exercise the political pressure I can bear. And so what we're seeing right now is people risking, you know, serious blacklisting, violence, losing their jobs while being arrested like they do on the Moral Mondays, all kinds of things. People are really putting themselves out there to desperately, you know, grasp at not a politician's attention, but their own people, their fellow people's attention, and that's powerful.
Yeah, it is, Sarah. And I just want to tell you, just thank you for your work. Thank you for coming on. And you're just, I think, you know, that moment, that 3-minute clip provides just a tremendous amount of inspiration for people around the country. But just your passion and your work in general, I think, does the same. And really appreciate you taking the time to come talk us today. And certainly, please stay in touch. And even more so if you get to New York, we'd love to have you in. And anything we can do to help you find some work up in New York, I think you probably won't need our help, would be my guess. But please stay in touch.
I will, Sam, and thanks for always staying committed to trying to find a way to get people that need to hear you. We really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Sarah. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome Sandra Steingraber. She is the author of Raising Elijah, Protecting Our Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis, as well as Living Downstream and Having Faith, and also the subject of a documentary by the same name, Living Downstream. Welcome to the program, Sandra.
Thank you for so much for having me.
So your book is it really is fantastic. I have two young children myself. We have gone through much of the sort of the same processes that you speak of in terms of dealing with the many ecological threats to our children. But I want to start first with this concept that you talk about in your book, well-informed futility. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. That's a concept I introduced right at the beginning of the book because I have come to believe it's our biggest problem for solving the very real environmental crisis that threatens the lives of our children. Of course, there are very many entrenched economic interests, the fossil fuel industry being one, that are at the source of the problem. But it's people's advanced resignation, their willingness to give up the fight before they've even enjoined it, that I find to be the biggest issue. People find this problem overwhelmingly depressing in a way that, you know, other problems like terrorism or a pedophile located in your community, all these other big and scary problems can swing us into action. But the idea that the world's plankton stocks are in trouble and therefore our oxygen supply is in trouble because plankton make us half the oxygen we breathe, and of course our kids need an oxygen supply, they need ice caps frozen to provide a normal weather pattern for them to grow crops, all these things cause our eyes to glaze over and cause us to be depressed. And so it turns out psychologists have a name for this phenomenon. It's called well-informed futility, and it refers to the feeling that we have when we learn about something that we feel that we have no agency over. So we hear about a terrible problem. We don't think there's anything we can do to fix it. And so it makes us feel so much unbearable grief or guilt or rage that rather than continue to feel that way, we start to turn away from more knowledge itself and then simply put our head in the sand and take a hear no evil, see no evil approach to it. It's very easy to do that when you have young kids because, of course, your job is to protect your children and not make them feel scared about something. And so you don't necessarily want to have a conversation about the fact that one in every four mammals is now going extinct because of climate change around the dinner table. And so because we don't want to talk about it in front of our kids, we parents end up not talking about it at all and live in this kind of infantilized happy bubble in which both, you know, bad news doesn't penetrate. And so that's the starting point of Raising Elijah. I want to march my readers right out of that bad place and make them feel that their action is actually going to make them feel better.
And it's interesting, too, because there's this, this in many respects, the agency that we have is both in the context of what we can do as individuals to protect our individuals' families, but ultimately that's not really enough in some respects. In other words,
right. So I take it. Yeah. So here's where my biologist background kind of comes into play. So Raising Elijah is really two books in one. It's my life in this sort of sloppy ecology of my own household, where I'm, you know, a busy working mother with these two lovely children, one of whom Elijah is born and grows up, you know, in the course of the book. And so you look at, you know, you see my laundry cycle and my food chain and how my husband and I do things in our house. But I'm also then taking a look at larger biological data to ask questions like, okay, I have given up a lawnmower and I've changed it out for a rotary mower. And in so doing, it turns out it actually saves me time because I use it like a Nautilus machine in the gym. And so I can get my daily workout and get the grass cut at the same time. And so it works for me, and I'm actually, you know, not putting X amount of carbon into the atmosphere and not creating carcinogenic smog that my son who has asthma would have to breathe. So what if we all did that? Would that actually make a difference? And it turns out if you scale up our individual responses like that, it actually doesn't make much of a difference. We need much larger scale change that involves redesigning our communities, involves fossil fuel companies having a willingness to leave their assets, their proven resources, reserves of fossil fuels actually in the ground, and a willingness to abandon that and go do something different. And so how can we bring about those kind of changes? So, you know, the book really ranges from me as a breastfeeding mother who's out there mowing the grass while my child is nursing under the tree. To me, as the biologist looking at these large-scale planetary data and thinking about how parents can join this big human rights movement that I see happening, which is a move away from this ruinous dependency on fossils, lighting them on fire to make our tea kettles whistle, and looking elsewhere for our sources of energy, namely looking at wind, water, and solar for running things.
You talk about it as a human rights struggle, and you you compare it to the the abolition of slavery in many respects, and talk about this, because there's the it's both in terms of the implications for us as individuals and our rights to not have what you call, I think, trespass by toxins, and also in terms of what it means for society, in that society has to make a decision about, on an economic level that is analogous to the one that we had to make with slavery.
Right. Well, that's well said. And so indeed, comparing our current situation to the abolitionist movement of the 1830s is a dominant part of the narrative of Raising Elijah, and it starts with the title itself. So my son is actually named Elijah, but his namesake, I named him after a childhood hero of mine, which is an Illinois abolitionist from the 1830s whose name was Elijah Lovejoy. And I was particularly moved by this. I mean, he's somebody that all Illinois school children used to learn about. He lived just down the Illinois River from where I grew up. And he was a writer and an author like I am. And living across the Mississippi from Missouri, which was a slave state, he saw the slave trade up close and personal. And it bothered him greatly, as it did a lot of people who lived in the free state of Illinois. But what really pushed him over the edge to abolitionist activism was when he became a father. So he had a two-year-old son, and his wife was pregnant with their second child, and his heart just broke open in seeing children sold away from their parents and families being broken up, knowing that how much parents, the kind of love, the big love that all parents have for their children. And so he faced a dilemma then, because he knew that then that slavery was an abomination, and he was committed to the for the rest of his life to ending this and dismantling this institution. But at the same time, it brought danger upon himself, because pro-slavery mobs started, you know, throwing brickbats through his windows. And so meanwhile, his two-year-old and his pregnant wife had to all sort of sleep in the same bed, and he had to sort of defend them. And he worried that if his life was lost, of course, then he wasn't really being a good father to his own children. And plus, all this abolitionist work was taking him away from making money and from being with his family and so on. So he wrote these personal letters to his mother about this dilemma he faced, that he had to do this as a father, and yet he was a terrible father for doing it. And so how to deal with that? And he finally decided that he was this larger need to recreate our nation's economy so his children could grow up in a place where no one was enslaved was really what he was called to do. So he was assassinated in the end, in his 30s, on his actually 35th birthday. He was buried and pumped full of 5 bullets by a pro-slavery mob who dumped his printing press into the Mississippi River, his home being in Alton, Illinois. And so, you know, he was martyred, and yet his words went on to inspire Harriet Beecher Stowe, Abraham Lincoln, John Brown, the Boston abolitionists, and so on. And so I really wanted to resurrect that spirit of abolition to say that, you know, there was a time in our history where people insisted that even though our economy was ruinously dependent on this institution, and that time it was slavery, there was personal wealth bound up, it kept the cost of goods low, kept us competitive in the world market, everyone kind of benefited from slave unpaid labor as consumers, whether you owned slaves or not, and yet somebody had to stand up and say, you know what, this is an abomination, it has to stop, and it has to stop now, and I don't care how much social unrest is created, and I don't care how much personal wealth evaporates in so doing, with immediate emancipation. And so I think our situation now is analogous, right? That I think we now have become enslaved to fossil fuels. It's having a ruinous effect on our climate, interfering now with our ability to have reliable grain harvests, interfering with pollination systems. All of these things our children need, and it's our job as parents to make sure they're there for them. And at the same time, as my colleague Bill McGibbon says, it's as though we're mounting a movement against ourselves. It's as though the slave owners are leading the abolitionist movement, because all of us depend on low cost of gas, oil, and coal. Our retirement accounts are invested in it. We heat our homes with it and so on. And so we're in a really vexing and tricky situation. And mounting a human rights movement is the kind of the way out of it, is what I argue in Raising Elijah.
And in some respects, I mean, you have, I mean, it's clear how you have resolved that, or maybe you haven't resolved it. It's ongoing, but that the ambivalence between being there for your kids and, but also in some ways, I guess being there for your kids in sort of a way that is more abstract, or one in which maybe abstract's the wrong word, but one which affects society at large, but in some ways may inhibit your ability to be there for your kids at that moment. I mean, I'm thinking last month. I mean, I imagine you just recently got out of prison. I mean, about 2 weeks ago.
I did, yes. And actually, I'm talking to you today from Norman, Oklahoma, where I am teaching a class. In fact, I just left my class where we were just talking about all these issues, teaching an honors class in extreme energy extraction and environmental health. And I felt compelled to come to Oklahoma, you know, just down the road here from some of the world's biggest oil and gas industry. Some of my students are petroleum engineering majors, and yet they, you know, my class was over-enrolled. There's this deep need to learn about and talk about these issues. But being here this week certainly takes me away from my own children who are in New York. And as you suggest, I also recently got out of jail for having done an act of civil disobedience, which I felt called to do in my work to halt the expansion of the infrastructure for fracking, which is a technique that is blowing up the bedrock of our nation in order to bring hydrocarbon gases like methane, which is natural gas, but also propane and butane, which are now being stored under the lake near which I live, which is a source of drinking water for 100,000 of us. And so that was where I planted my own flag of civil disobedience and went to jail. And it actually gave, you know, every year I do an Earth Day lecture. I'm always somewhere talking on Earth Day. This year I was delivering my Earth Day lecture from cell number one at cell block 5D in the Chemung County Jail in the southern tier of New York. But I feel like that was the most important scientific statement that I could make. And as I told my children before I went to jail, you know, mom's on the job. I mean, it is my job to make sure that my children are protected from harm and they have a future. They can't have a future if the planet's climate system is wrecked to the point where they can't have stable food anymore. So just in the same way that it's my job to make sure there's money for them to go to college and you know, they get to their piano lessons on time and all the rest, and wear their bike helmets when they ride their bike because they protect them from dangerous situations. The situation that we face with fossil fuels has become very dangerous, not only because of things that have happened within my lifetime, but the fact that other generations before me have failed to mount a challenge that's sufficient to the task, so that we now face, you know, because of the cumulative effect here, we face these calamitous tipping points and a big cliff of calamity that we're about to go over. And that it's my job as a parent, not only as a biologist, but also as a mom, to stop that. So I have told my children that there may be a time when I can be a better mother to you inside of a jail cell than outside, and I realize that will cause you to cry, but I'm hoping that your tears will be less than the tears of all children and grandchildren to come if we don't take action. And what I say in Raising Elijah about all that, which of course was written before I actually put on the orange jumpsuit and went to jail, but I was sort of anticipating that day might come as I wrote, what I say about all that is, you know, this is not that unusual, that when I look back in history, starting with Elijah Lovejoy, there were all kinds of parents who loved their children just as much as we do, who were just as busy, who worked just as hard, and had to balance, you know, buying the costume for the school play with the report that's due tomorrow at work and the kid who's homesick and throwing up all night while you're trying to, you know, get your house redecorated. I mean, these are things that have always gone on. And yet there have been parents, whether Elijah Lovejoy or in the case of my dad's generation, people who fought against the rise of global fascism, who had to work against Hitler at great risk to themselves and at risk to their own children, and had to send their children away, in some cases, to grow up away from them so they didn't, in case they were caught, they didn't, you know, put their children's lives at jeopardy. Well, now there is no safe place to send our children. The whole planet is in jeopardy. And so we might have to send ourselves away, you know, to be apart from our kids in order to be a better parent to them.
Yeah.
My own life, I have a great marriage. And so, you know, my work is made easier by the fact that my husband and I co-parent. And as Jeff says, you know, that's why kids have two parents, in case one of them has to go to jail. So, so we're making it work. And I hope my story is inspiring in some way to others.
And I should note that you specifically decided not to pay a $350-some-odd fine, but instead chose to head to jail for, I guess it was, ended up being 10 days. Why do you call the statement that you made about Earth regarding Earth Day from jail an important scientific statement?
Well, I think that two things. First of all, that the specific problem which I was addressing, which is the threat to drinking water by the storage of explosive hydrocarbon gases in salt chambers beneath and under the lake, as well as the attendant air pollution created by the compressor stations, the truck traffic, all the diesel machinery and so on that runs all that, as the, sort of this massive industrialization of an otherwise pristine body of drinking water, that if I could solve the problem as a scientist by letting the data speak, I would have happily done it. I believe that science should tell us how to do things. And so I have testified about this problem. I have submitted petitions and so on. And there are at least three different government agencies who are in charge of regulating and making decisions, yes or no, about what can go on with this facility on Seneca Lake. And one of them is our State Department of Environmental Conservation in New York, and then there are two other federal agencies. And so I have communicated with all of them. The problem is that the company itself is claiming that the data about the structural integrity of the salt caverns and the underlying geology is a trade secret. And so I don't have access to that information. Nobody does. And we have, some of our best journalists have tried through Freedom of Information Law request to get a hold of it, and it was redacted. And so if the companies privatize the knowledge, then how can those of us in the scientific community offer informed comment to our decision makers about the wisdom or folly of burying explosive gases underneath a source of drinking water? That's what frustrated me. And also then, speaking now as a mother, Elijah himself was born in this place. So the West Bank of Seneca Lake, there used to be a birth center there that right around 9/11 he was born. So I became a mother of a son just as this terrible act of terrorism was happening. And so for me, the west bank of that lake with the frog sounds was the place in the midst of all this chaos that our country was about ready to plunge into, and all the horror of all that, was this beautiful refuge. It was his birthplace. That's where I, you know, the bank of that lake is where I walked while in labor with him and delivered him. And so it's a sacred and important place. And so the idea that this is being ruined and industrialized for the purpose of carrying on a fossil fuel addiction made me feel in a motherly way like, look, I came to this place and did this very physically athletic and intense thing. I gave birth to a 10-pound baby boy without any anesthetic right on the bank of this lake. So now I'm going to take my body back to the same place and place it in front of a compressor station and blockade it. And then I'm not going to pay the fine, because that's the problem, right? The same company has been in violation of its maximum discharge into the lake. It discharges chemicals into the lake, and every quarter for 12 quarters it exceeds the legal amount, and it simply pays a fine for the crime and walks away. So for me to say, I don't believe in paying fines to excuse a crime, so therefore you'll have to put my body in jail. So I'm going to take my body now that gave birth to the sun and then stood out in a blizzard and blockaded the site. Now I'm going to do something, a third extreme thing with my body, which is to put it in a jail cell. And that will be, I will let my body speak, because you're not letting me speak as a scientist, because you're not giving me access to the data. So that was kind of the framework for my Earth Day message this year.
And in the book, you also say that fracking is the single largest environmental threat to children's health. Just explain that to us.
Sure. So of all the different industries that I have looked at and the kinds of challenges to our public health that they create, you know, over the last 20 years as an environmental health scientist, I've looked at everything from the ability of the pesticide atrazine to alter the timing of puberty in girls. I've looked at the ability of air pollution to shorten human gestation and increase the risk for preterm birth and how that contributes to infant mortality and so on. But of all the things I've looked at, I've never seen a bigger emerging threat than fracking. And that's because this is an industry that does two things that I don't know if any other industry does. First of all, it's exempt from most of our federal environmental laws. So it gets a pass. It doesn't have to report all the chemicals it uses, unlike all the other industries. So we have laws on the books, right, that say that if you're going to put an inherently toxic chemical into the environment that we all share, let's like say our air or our drinking water, you have to tell the public if that chemical leaves your factory walls and goes out into the environment. You have to report that to our government. But the laws are suspended for fracking, so it has a deliberate exemption from all these laws. So I can't get my hands on the data. We don't collect the data. We don't have emissions data. We don't have right to know for me to actually determine what the impact on health is going to be from fracking. And then the second thing is that I don't know any other industry that can use our land as its factory floor. There's no zoning. There's no separation. So in order for oil or natural gas to be blasted out of the shale bedrock a mile below our feet, the oil and gas industry sets up shop right on our private land, right in our community, sometimes next to daycare centers, in neighborhoods, on our farm fields, and so on. And so this is an industry that's not sort of away from where we live. It's scattered all over. And in order to work, of course, it has to tunnel sideways through the bedrock, shatter it, and pump it full of sand, water, and toxic chemicals to get these tiny bubbles of gas that are trapped in there, kind of like a spill of petrified champagne, if you will, to get those to flow up and out the borehole. And while they do that, while the hole is being drilled, all kinds of other toxicants that are trapped inside our bedrock, things like radon, benzene, that are just naturally down there, but they're not hurting anybody as long as they stay entombed, those things are also emancipated along with the natural gas. And so each one of these wellheads is kind of like a chimney in the earth where you get these hazardous air pollutants that are released. And we can do a little bit with regulations to try to capture some of that, but in fact, a lot of it is released before the well is even hooked up to the pipeline. And of course, cement, which is what is the liner for the well, is not an immortal substance. So it cracks, it shrinks, we all know what kind of old crumbly cement looks like. And so the cement is supposed to serve as an immortal barrier forevermore between the harmful chemicals that are trapped in our bedrock and then our underlying drinking water aquifers. But we know that, in fact, gas wells leak. 6% of them leak right away. And over time, as those well casings age and begin to crumble, they become like people that have osteoporosis, right? And they tend to crack and fracture. And so then you have pathways for these inherently toxic substances to find their way up to us, either through air or water. Over what time period, we're not even sure. But this it concerns me greatly that we may be laying time bombs in the earth that may not only affect us, but future generations as well. So this is worrying about fracking and not only studying it and researching it, but now I feel morally obligated as a scientist, knowing what I know, to actually stop it. So when I received the Heinz Award in 2011 for my research and writing on environmental health, I donated the cash award that came with that, this nice $100,000 check, to the anti-fracking movement of New York, out of my desire not just to study the issue, but to actually protect people, to intervene in a precautionary way. And that money became the seed money for New Yorkers Against Fracking, which I'm really pleased to say has now become, started out just as an alliance of a handful of groups, and now is a kind of a mighty, the little engine that could, that became this sort of mighty force. Now we're more than 200 different organizations, 500 different church leaders, 1,000 different businesses. We have, you know, Poets Against Fracking, Students Against Fracking, Chefs for the Marcellus, and scientists and physicians have joined. And so we have become a voice for the anti-fracking movement in New York, and we really seek to not just say no to fracking, but to bring data out before our policymakers, before our governor, before the people, to show that we could turn our state into a showcase for renewable energy and help our farmers supplement farm income by, for example, having a solar array in their back 40 instead of a drill head, and contribute energy, renewable energy, to the grid. We could plug in our electric cars into that grid, and so on. That we actually have good data that this is now workable, and we wish to now actualize and operationalize these good ideas. So on June 17th, New Yorkers Against Fracking is going to be rallying in Albany, June 17th being the day that the Statue of Liberty first arrived on our shores 128 years ago, and now we're going to use the anniversary of her arrival to say that New York once again wishes to, you know, raise the lamp to the world to show a path to renewable energy. So we're at a crossroads here. We want to close the door on ruinous fossil fuel extraction, just as we years ago helped close the door on slavery, and redesign our economy so we're no longer dependent on these things that are harming our children and killing the planet.
All right, Sandra. Lastly, let me just ask how your kids. I mean, from I assume you've spoken to your children about your work, and they speak of it. But how do they perceive it? I mean, we've heard it, you know, from your perspective, and you also mention a story of a teacher, and I cannot remember what the time was, but talking to her class regarding their perception of whether they'll end up dying in a nuclear war. But and I imagine
right.
that
yeah, that and that and that's been a very animating story. I mean, I won't. I mean, look, I'm not going to say everything's all sunshine and roses in my household. For sure, there are conflicts. I mean, next week I'll be at a press conference about fracking, and for that I will miss my son's spring concert, and he doesn't even know that yet. I haven't broken the news to him yet, and I feel terrible about that issue. On the other hand, in a larger way, my kids feel reassured by my activism, knowing that I'm on the job. And of course, kids always feel that their parents are sort of capable of more than we really are. They sort of think of us as superheroes. So I'm always interested in like living up to my kids' belief in the power they think I have. So for them, it's very ordinary. You know, I might come home from Washington or from Albany. I've been testifying, or I've been, you know, doing research or whatever I'm doing, and I'll walk in the door, sort of my, you know, sword dragging in the dust, and they'll look up from their homework and say, "Okay, hi, Mom, have you stopped fracking yet?" You know, they, as though I were fully capable of doing that, and that calms them down because they can see that I'm working on their behalf. So for all of their kind of grumbles about my absence, and I certainly do a lot of homework, you know, over the phone from hotel rooms and things like that. But I do remember the story that one of my readers told me about a third grade teacher who, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when our relationships with the Soviet Union couldn't have been worse, right? And people were really half thinking this was it, that the bombs were going to start flying, that her third grade class was so freaked out that they could not even go through their lessons. And so she began a conversation with them and realized during that conversation that every one of these eight-year-olds thought that they were going to die in a nuclear war, except for one child. And she asked that one child, "Well, how come you think everything's fine?" And she said, "Because my parents are peace activists and they're going to stop it." So with that story, I began to realize, you know, my job as a parent is not to come up with the perfect narrative about climate change. Like, you know, it's my job to come up with the story of where babies came from. I don't have to come up with the perfect story that's, you know, just alarming but not too alarming about climate change. I don't have to do that. All I have to do is go out and stop it and have my kids watch me and witness me in action. That's what calms them down, is seeing that their parents are engaged, that they aren't turning away from the big moral issues of our time. They're really the heroes of the story, and our kids want us to be heroes, so let's just go do it. It's going to require heroic action. This is a really big problem, but who doesn't want to be a hero? And now here's our chance. And so all kinds of other parents throughout history have had to do heroic things when they had young kids. So I'm always interested in their stories, like how did the French people in the French Resistance do it? How did the abolitionists who ran the Underground Railroad do it? They had kids too, sometimes a lot more than I did, right? And they didn't even have a washing machine. So how did they manage that? And so I think we can do it too. I really do.
Sandra Steingraber, the book is Raising Elijah, Protecting Our Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis. Thanks so much for spending the time today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. Now, what we're going to do at this point is, okay, I know what I want to do. Before we call this guy up, I want to play a clip from a town hall that took place in Auburn, Alabama. And this took place, I guess the other day, right? I mean, this was just the other day. It was on Tuesday, and Representative Mike Rogers from Alabama is in a town hall meeting. Some guy gets up and starts talking about how President Obama is changing the Constitution and blah, blah, blah.
He should be impeached.
Should be impeached. And this other guy, John Mullins, in his 50s, lifelong resident of Auburn, Alabama, has just had enough. And he stands up and he basically says, you're whack. You're completely crazy. And frankly, the thing that's hurting me as a small businessman is the sequester and your desires to continually cut the deficit at a time of low economic growth. Let's play this clip of part of what John Mullins had to say.
My next question was, my business is off by 20% because of the sequester. I have gone from making good money to losing money in 1 month because of the sequester. You are putting where I am actually related to you, believe it or not.
I got a lot of kinfolks. I doubt it all.
I'm 57 years old, a lifetime resident of this town, been in business for 15 years. The House of Representatives have done more to hurt my business than anything government by anybody, state, local, federal, has ever done in that 15 years. Every time y'all do something and cut funding, it hurts my customers. They have less money to spend. When they have less money to spend, they spend less with me, which means I have less money. You're putting where I actually are destroying my business by the sequester. That I used to teach economics. The way to spend, there are only two times you should deficit spend, time of war and time of economic recession. You shouldn't be trying to cut government spending during recession because one of the only things that has money to spend is the government. That the Republicans tried to do that in the Great Depression. They did an austerity program immediately. It put millions of people more out of work. I don't want to be out of work. I've had a business for 15 years. I don't want to be out of work. I've already lost my wife 2 years ago, one that was maybe why I'm a relative of yours. I don't want to lose the only other thing that I care about anymore.
All right, so we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to John Mullins and have him tell us basically, you know, what got him to stand up and say that. And I don't know. I just want to hear more of his story.
Sam Cedar. He puts the truth inside your radio.
On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program, the man we just heard from in that clip from a town hall meeting held by Representative Mike Rogers of Alabama, John Mullins. John, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, sir.
Now, John, this was, I got to tell you, it was so refreshing to see someone, I guess in the presence of a congressman, talk about some of the most basic and obvious economic principles that we now we've seen this lesson about austerity in Europe. We're seeing it in this country. But first, just tell us, set the scene for everybody. You're sitting in this town hall meeting. One of your fellow town members gets up, and I couldn't quite make out what was he saying about the president at this point.
The first thing out of his mouth was talking about the president being a terrorist.
I see.
And then he proceeded to say that he was going to read a list of 20 illegal things that the president had done. And I started shaking my head. And I was sitting directly in front of the man, and he said, I noticed the gentleman in front of me is shaking his head. So I turned to him and told him he was crazy.
And at that point, it seemed like you had just basically had enough at that point.
Yes, sir. I told him I was tired of hearing talk like that, that I just couldn't take it anymore. I was planning on waiting until I was called upon, and then I was going to talk about how my business was impacted by the sequester, but I just couldn't take it anymore. I'm sorry. There's the level of political discourse in this country has deteriorated so much. I'm ashamed of it. Politics is supposed to be the art of compromise, and you can't compromise with people when they're alienating both sides by rhetoric like that. There's no place for it in our, just crazy talk like that in our political discourse. There's way too many more important things going on that we need to work together and achieve results. I'm sorry, it just yeah. upset me tremendously.
I understand. I mean, and one of the biggest problems is that it's not just rhetoric. I mean, when one of your fellow townspeople gets up and says this, they're not saying it to score any political points. They're saying it because they believe it. Where do you think this comes from?
It comes from, there's the left has some, problems too with
sure.
stuff like this, but not like the right. It's drilled into them by right wing media. I mean, it's these crazy people that just want to make money by stirring up trouble.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care about the country, really. All they care about is making money, and they make money by putting the most outrageous things out there will attract the attention of people that don't have anything better to do.
So let's talk some of the more substantive comments that you made to the representative, and I hope he heard them. You basically laid it out there. Now, you mentioned in that clip we listened to that you used to teach economics.
Yes, sir.
Just tell us a little bit about that and tell us about the basic principles that you explained to your congressman, we now have everyone from the IMF to now, fortunately, leaders in Europe to Nobel Prize winning economics professors who have echoed the same sentiments that you explained to your congressman.
It's basic, simple economics. It's not rocket science. It's the most basic, simple facts of economics. I've always considered myself actually a fiscal conservative, and there's only two times that government has a legitimate reason to deficit spend, as far as I'm concerned, and that is in time of war and in time of the economic recession. In fact, it's not only do they have the need to, it's an imperative that they do in either of those two times. It's why we should never have a balanced budget amendment, because in time of war, it's obvious why. In time of economic recession, though, the government is one of the few places that still has money that can be spent. That money is spent, should be spent on things like infrastructure projects and stuff like that that stimulate the economy. The way it does that is that that money, say, goes to a somebody that's building roads, and they take that money and they spend it, say, at the grocery store. And the grocery store pays their employees, and you know, money trickles down to the farmers and the canners and the meat packers. But it's all, we're all tied together. Just like the quote, you know, no man is an island unto himself. That is especially true in the economy, that you take $1 out of the economy, the federal government taking $1 out of the economy, takes $7 out of the economy.
And this is known as...
That money is spent over and over and over again. It's passed through private... Once it's spent by the government, it goes through private individuals over and over again. And every time you take money out of that one person's hands, you take the money out of the hands of the next person they do business with. And it just... It's exponential.
Right, and this is known as the multiplier effect. Now,
yeah,
you were telling your congressman that you're already feeling the impact of the sequester.
Yes, sir.
Give me a sense of how you know it's the sequester, and give me a sense of what that impact is.
Okay, well, I had already pretty much recovered from the recession in my business. I had been stable income for over a quarter. I had recovered back to almost where I was before. Then in the month of April, started out fine, but as you know, the month of April's when sequester hit.
Mm-hmm.
I had no new competition in the area, no other explanations whatsoever. As the month progressed, my sales kept dropping and dropping and dropping. Over the entire month, it was a 20% drop in sales in 1 month. That is a tremendous drop. It got worse as the month progressed. If you're talking about towards the end of the month, you're talking about a 50% drop.
Now tell me, have your fellow, are you aware of other business people in town who have had a similar?
Yes, I'm, like I told them, I've been here for 57 years. I talk to my fellow business owners daily. They are all expressing the fact that their business, even the grocery stores in town, are off. And you know, if people have to buy groceries, in my business, it's a commodity people don't have to have.
Right.
It's discretionary income spent in my business. And that's the first thing that gets hurt. You know, when you don't have to buy something, that's the first thing that you cut when you're... So, but I'm being told that it's even impacting the grocery stores already around here.
Wow.
And if that's the case, we're looking at serious financial problems, not only for the people, but for the local governments. I mean, if my sales are down by 20%, that means my sales tax revenue is down by 20%.
Indeed.
That means that even if there's only a 5% drop, that will put the city of Auburn in a financial crisis. It also, the state sales tax, and not only that, my income tax will be down. So the federal government gets less money. It's a cycle that has to be broken, and the only people that have the money is to break that cycle is the federal government right now. It has to be broken. We would already be fully recovered out of this recession if it was not for Republican obstructionists blocking every single thing that could help the economy. We were improving tremendously in the economy until the midterm elections. I saw a drop in my business within 1 month after the midterm elections, where I'd already recovered once from the recession, got hit again by the Republicans coming in and cutting things, and now I'm getting hit a third time. I mean, this has got to stop. It's like they don't care. It's like they don't care what happens to this country as long as Obama doesn't get any credit whatsoever for an improving economy. And I find it disgusting. I'm sorry. I've been a middle of the roader independent-minded person and to see people doing, to see our representatives doing things that harm our country instead of helping it. I love my country. I don't want to see it hurt. And they're destroying it. They're destroying our economy. They're going to make us weaker all over. I mean, it's going to hurt our national defense even because they don't seem to understand that all of us do better when all of us do better. When the poor do better, the rich do better. It goes back to Henry Ford paying his employees enough to buy the cars that he made. Now, he realized that. We're all tied together. We only do as well as the worst of us do.
Now, John, give me a sense of, one of the things that I love about that clip is that as you're explaining about the two times that you expressed that economics requires the government to spend more is during a time of recession, during a time of war, you can hear somebody in the background go, you know, sort of a, huh, like you just connected with someone. I'm curious, what's been the response locally to that clip? I mean, I imagine if I've seen it on Huffington Post, I imagine it's also been going around locally. What's been the response by local folks in Auburn, Alabama?
Actually, I was overwhelmed by total strangers coming by my store all day long yesterday, thanking me. I've never had that many people thank me for anything in my life. It was very moving. Like I said, I had no intention of being, having my 15 minutes of fame or whatever. But it was very moving. People coming in here wanting to shake my hand and telling me that what I said meant so much to them. And they wished that more people than wished that they had the guts to speak up like that I had. It was just overwhelming.
Well, John,
I was very moved by it. I was not expecting it. I felt, actually, when I walked out of there, I felt alone. And now I feel loved in the, it was quite a powerful experience for me. And I'm glad that I touched a chord with at least the local people, and maybe I can with the country, because I love my country so much, and I want to see it. I lost my wife 2 years ago, and my country and my business are the only things I have left, and I want to see both of them survive and to prosper. And it tears me apart to see people doing things that aren't in the best interest of all of us and in the best interest of our country as a whole. And they don't see how short-sighted they are. And I know, they say that they're for the 1%, but don't they understand that the 1% needs the people? They won't have money if people below them don't have money to spend. They will lose their fortunes too. I mean, it just will take longer to do so, but they depend on those little people to buy their products and to buy their, I just don't see this short-sighted, just looking at quarterly profits rather than long-term growth. And, you get high quarterly profits by cutting people's wages or cutting your workforce, but you can't grow a business that way. Stuff I hear like, oh, you can't raise taxes on the job creators. I'm sorry, that's not economically sound either, because I've tried to explain this to people and they get it when I tell them. I go, look, when you hire an employee, that employee is a business expense. It's written off your taxes. If you're paying taxes at, say, a 30% rate, it costs you 70% to hire that employee. If you're taxed at a 90% rate, it only costs you 10% to hire that employee. So you have a more economic incentive to hire the higher your tax rate. That's why we had such investment in the 50s when the tax rate was so high. Because the lower the tax rate, the less incentive there is for somebody to hire somebody. And anybody that tells you that, you know, you hire somebody based on your marginal tax rate is crazy. You hire somebody because you need them, because you have more business and that are more, you need more productivity and you need that person. You don't hire them based on a tax rate. No business has ever done that. The only way you do that is if you had an incentive to hire, like you got a tax credit for hiring somebody. Right. That's the only reason you'd hire somebody for a tax. This stuff about, you know, is totally insane, does not make a bit of sense economically. It is actually the opposite of what is true, you know, and you're hearing it the same way with a sequester. You wait till the economy recovers, and then you cut stuff, because when the economy recovers, you have more tax revenue coming in, because you have more people's earning an income and paying in taxes. That means that you can cut and balance a budget without being so draconian in your cuts.
Right.
And people need to understand that. You don't cut while the economy is bad. That just makes the economy worse. You wait until the economy recovers, and then you do it. Like I said, I'm a fiscal conservative, and this goes beyond everything that any economist would ever tell you is right. I mean, I don't know where they're getting, you know, these. It's almost like they're trying to destroy the country, and I hope to God they aren't that way. I don't like to believe things like that about people. I like to think the best of people, but I see it doesn't make any sense. The only way it makes sense at all that they would be doing this is simply to keep the president from getting any credit for the economy recovering. And that's the only reason I could see for this. Nothing else makes any sense whatsoever. And
well,
that's not an economic reason. That's a political reason. And that's not what they're supposed to be doing.
I can tell you, John, this idea of austerity is one that has had far too much legs, even internationally speaking, and hopefully...
Well, they're learning it internationally and turning that around.
That's
already.
Right.
We need to learn it here. We don't need to be behind the curve. We need to be ahead of the curve.
Well, you're absolutely right about that, John. And let me just say, I really appreciate your talking to us today. And I really appreciate not just your speaking out in that environment, but also that you have provided for folks a model of how you can go down to these town halls. They're happening all across the country right now because representatives are visiting their hometowns, and you can speak up and you can inject some reality into this discourse. So, John Mullins, I'm glad that you've got good response there locally, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, hopefully we can get this country turned around and back on its feet, because I want to see America, I want to see it back to being the home of the free and the home of the brave and the free. I'm sorry, it hurts me so bad, because I love my country so much, and I wanted to see it back to its previous greatness.
Well, more folks speak up like you do. I think we will get there.
That's how, you know, democracy works. You got to speak out. You can't, you know, if you want anything done, you do have to speak up. I mean, it's let your congressmen know, you know, let your senators know, but especially Congress, because Congress controls the purse strings. You know, it says in the Constitution that all bills of revenue must originate in the House of Representatives. The House You can only blame the House for our economy. You cannot blame the president. He can only do what the House passes. And if the House passes, won't pass anything, there's very little the president can do. And people need to know their civics. They need to know that that's the case. If you want to blame somebody for the economy, blame the House of Representatives, because that's where it has to start. That's the only people that can really move the thing forward. If it isn't moved forward there, it'll never happen. And instead, they're doing everything to destroy our economy instead of help it.
Well, John Mullins, again, thank you so much for joining us.
And God bless the United States of America.
I appreciate you talking to us. Bye-bye.
Thank you, sir. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.